Sarcoidosis is a chronic, systemic, non-infectious granulomatous disorder of unknown etiology, which often presents with skin lesions. In our next dialogue, Dr. Joseph English and Dr. Michael Heffernan discuss current thoughts regarding sarcoidosis.
Hello, this is Mike Heffernan. We have Dr. Joe English from Pittsburgh University. He's a professor of dermatology joining us today. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Mike.
Today we're going to be talking about a disease that's near and dear to both of our hearts, which is sarcoidosis. We take care of a lot of patients with this. So why don't we get started with something about the history or the epidemiology of sarcoid?
Sarcoid is a non-infectious granulomatous disease that we really don't know what causes it. And it likes to affect just not black patients, but basically all races, all ages, all sexes.
And is it uniform across those? Is it not more common in certain subgroups?
Well, yes, it is more common in the black female, black male, followed by the Caucasian female, Caucasian male in epidemiology studies. But it's also worldwide. It can occur in different places in different rates.
Is it not more common in the first world?
I do believe it is. It's a disease of industrialized nations.
And there's been a lot of speculation about that. Is there any new data on anything of why that would be?
The proceedings from the Thoracic Society showed that they had 704 new cases, and they couldn't find one single etiology that was with the same 700 patients. They looked at the 43 cases of sarcoidosis at the World Trade Center disaster. If you were at the debris site, you were at higher risk than if you were in the cloud after the towers fell. But overall, they show that healthcare workers are at higher risk, firemen are at higher risk, people that work with aerosols or pesticides are at a little bit higher risk. So they really just don't have the answer what causes it. People that don't smoke usually get sarcoid more than smokers, but they say smoking is not protective, so don't start.
Is there a standard historical questions that you ask your patients when they first come in with sarcoid?
Well, the classic systemic disease is berylliosis, which is a exposure to beryllium. And you wouldn't think it'd be active in your practice, but I had a patient that came with generalized complaints, but a nonspecific dermatitis. And he was a ceramic painter. And so that's one of the risk factors for berylliosis. The berylliosis mimics sarcoid systemically, not so much cutaneous. It just gives you kind of a nonspecific dermatitis. You can ask about their occupation. As we said, we work in healthcare, what they might be exposed to on a daily basis.
And then do we have an idea about any genetic or immunologic influences and in what's setting you up for sarcoid?
Oh, there's a lot of recent new articles. There was one in JAMA from 2011, I do believe, that has an excellent review, and we'll get that on our list of references for everybody. We do know that immunologically it's a CD4 Th1 reaction to an exogenous antigen. Those cells then become compartmentalized. It produces cytokines that induce the granuloma formation. Over time, it changes to a Th2 cell type, which will cause more of a fibrotic type cytokine pattern. But there's a lot of other things, Th17 cells. There's so many different things that it's pretty advanced. It kind of mimics the disease on etiology. There's so many little different things that we think could be causing it, but we don't have the answer.
There's been speculation that there was an infectious etiology behind it.
Yes, TB was the classic. They haven't been able to have a sarcoidal patient be biopsied and grow out the culture. They've had immune reactions to specific tuberculoid antigens, but not the actual organism grow out. People don't die from immunosuppressive therapy we put on them from fulminant bacterial infections. So I still think, just like all the non-infectious granulomatous diseases, they're an immune reaction to what? Probably infection may be for some, but not every case of sarcoidosis.
And it's more of an aberrant immune reaction.
You are correct. So these people aren't immunosuppressed. They're overactive. The other two things infection-wise, there have been a couple case reports of hepatitis C patients developing sarcoidosis, and also they mentioned P. acnes as a possibility, but there's not the definitive cause.
Many dermatologists are quite familiar with a number of the cutaneous manifestations of sarcoid. Do you want to maybe go through some of those common and maybe less common forms of sarcoid that we'll see in the skin?
Sure. It's broken down to two sections. One is specific, and that is when you biopsy the skin lesion, you find granulomas. The nonspecific type are reactive changes. Those are the erythema nodosum, clubbing, pruritus. The specific lesions are multiple, but the classic ones are macropapular disease, papulonodular disease, plaque disease. You can develop subcutaneous. And then the classic lupus pernio. I think that the classic lupus pernio is commonly confused with any sarcoid presentation on the nose. You see a lot of studies now that come out saying, oh, we got the cure for lupus pernio. When you look at it, it was macropapular sarcoidosis and not the infiltrative, more chronic, very difficult to get rid of disease. Unique cases, or atypical cases, I call them, acquired ichthyosis can be classic, and you actually biopsy the ichthyosis and find the granulomas. There is secondary scarring alopecia from sarcoidosis. Afro-American women, especially on the extremities, can develop a verrucous sarcoidosis. There's also ulcerative that can mimic a lower leg venous ulcer to infectious ulcer. And there's also morpheiform. They talk about subcutaneous disease can be just nodules, but also can occur on the upper extremities, more common in women, that will have usual lung findings on x-ray.
And that's the Darier-Rousset form of sarcoid?
Yeah, you probably think that's the subcutaneous variant where you get multiple subcutaneous nodules, yes.
Okay. And then do you have any data on what percentage of people are going to present with classic lupus pernio or other forms of it?
Well, they say that 25% of patients with systemic sarcoidosis have skin lesions. I would probably say that obviously the atypical cases I mentioned are the less common. Micro or macropapular, papulonodular, and plaque are the most common. Lupus pernio is not that common.
Okay. And then do you find that most of your patients, when you make the diagnosis of sarcoid in their skin, that they already know that they have systemic sarcoidosis, or is that a de novo diagnosis?
It's about 50-50, because I have some people come in and they didn't realize what they had, and we found out that they've had cutaneous, and then you find out they had eye disease or lung disease. But then also, too, after developing a relationship with the pulmonology department, that they have a lot of people that come in with the lung findings, and they send me for their cutaneous exam, just a full exam. Sometimes you find something, sometimes you don't.
And is that when you're more likely to wind up biopsying ichthyosis or other lesions that are sort of the less common variants?
Well, as Mike, you know, in your days in academia, that usually you get cases that aren't straightforward always the time. So if I see acquired ichthyosis, I'm biased. I always biopsy it, you know, just to make sure it's not sarcoid or CTCL or something atypical. I have a tendency to do it a little bit more often than you might in the private practice setting.
What of the atypical forms do you tend to see more often than you expect?
The scalp. Scarring, sarcoidosis of the scalp can mess up a lot of people. And I've seen people send it to me for folliculitis decalvans or lichen planopilaris. And biopsy can easily tell the difference, but you can see that. And that's a unique finding sometimes. I've had a couple Caucasians, but usually that's black patients that have this scalp involvement. Yeah.
And a couple of the people that I've had with that as adults, it's often looked like a carrion or even tinea capitis because of the scaling that's on there. And you never see that in an adult. And so it's really kind of unique.
You're right. I mean, if the patient, as you know, is like an Afro-American patients that are immunosuppressed or HIV, your thing for fungus goes up. But if they come in and they're not, and you're getting this weepy mass on the scalp, you're like, what is it? Are there times you might give someone an antibiotic first, have it try to clear up and come back? You know, that can be the case. I had one patient that had cutis verticis gyrotis at the same time, and that was messing everybody up for what was going on with the scalp process. So you're right, it's you got to keep it in the back of your mind, but it may not be the first thing that jumps out.
And so obviously skin biopsy is going to be the main way that you're making a diagnosis, and any pearls for biopsying sarcoid?
I usually try to go to areas that don't bleed a lot. So usually it's try to one that's not on the eyelid. I'll do face and extremities, but it can affect any part. So, but hopefully in an area that's a little bit easier and you can hide the biopsy scar.
And then how often do you get a definitive diagnosis of sarcoid on biopsy? And how many times does the pathologist sort of equivocate and say that it's some sort of granulomatous disease or otherwise?
What's the most important person for a dermatologist is a dermatopathologist. So if people know when I call and I say I have sarcoid, my guy will come out and say this is non-caseating granuloma consistent with sarcoid or metastatic Crohn's or something of that nature. He rarely gives me a kind of a blah type answer. So that's kind of hard for me to answer per se, but non-caseating granuloma, you know, what do you worry about? Metastatic Crohn's, chylitis granulomatosis, which is on the face. You'd probably have to understand if it wasn't on the face. And sarcoid. So those are the big ones you want to think about.
And sometimes there are GA-like presentations.
Yes, this, you bring up an excellent point. The issue with that is, and I tell even my residents when I teach them, if you see GA on the hand, you just can't walk in and say, hey, that looks like an annular lesion of GA. You have to biopsy it, because there's so many times where sarcoid will mimic GA, mimic necrobiosis lipoidica diabeticorum. So all those are the class three, the top three I always say that, hey, you have to do a biopsy. So it comes back GA. Okay, then we're done. We don't have to worry about anything, you know, unless it's disseminated GA, and that's a whole other dialogue in dermatology.
And so we talked briefly about some of the systemic manifestations of sarcoidosis. How do you break those down, and how do you evaluate for those?
Well, the biggest concern are the ones that are going to cause trouble. Cardiac and neurologic involvement are not easy to find, and I'll talk about those at the end, but usually up front, simple things that you can do to look for disease or blood work. Patients are anemic, blood count. We look at their chemistry, especially serum calcium, because patients are often hypercalcemic. They have one of the highest risks for kidney stones in the, compared to the general population. You can check liver function, renal function, thyroid function. Just came out in the archives in this past issue in 2012. Misha Rosenbach's group showed that patients had a little higher risk for hypothyroidism. So you can check that. Urinalysis, just to make sure they don't have blood from a kidney stone. Obviously, skin biopsy we talked about, and obviously your history and physical is always given. What I usually do with my patients, get them to ophthalmologist right off the bat to get the eye exam done. I order a chest x-ray, and I'll automatically go ahead and get PFTs done, because that'll save some time for the pulmonologist. I don't go order a high-resolution CT scan, which they may do, but I don't think we have to do that at this point as a dermatologist. The next step is I get an EKG on everybody. If they have a right bundle branch block, you look get a little nervous, or left ventricular hypertrophy. Echocardiogram, I like to order, because that can be done before they go to the visit, and see if they have wall motion abnormalities or thickening of the ventricle.
When you said visit, you mean with the cardiologist?
With the cardiologist, right. I like to have that done for them to go. So then, and then the neurology, that's a tough one, you know, and that's based on symptoms. And I let that right up to the neurologist, because I'm not going to do a spinal tap in clinic. Obviously, you could order an MRI, but we try to be cost effective. But I think getting those things like the chest x-ray, PFTs, eye exam, and the cardiac issues, it helps to facilitate the overall care of the patient.
So when you take a patient who has cutaneous sarcoid and say their labs are normal, their x-ray is normal, do you have all of those patients see ophthalmology, pulmonology, cardiology, and neurology?
Well, I would say everyone sees ophthalmology and pulmonology, because 90% of sarcoid patients have eye or lung involvement. If there's anything on the cardiac findup, then I refer to cardiology, neurology based on symptoms. It's hard to figure those out. The other thing else is, what happens when you get the biopsy back that shows you have, looks like cutaneous sarcoid, this is cutaneous sarcoid, and everything you've done so far is you can't find anything else. Does a person have sarcoidosis? Some always say you had to have two organ systems. Well, unless you go and biopsy the liver or biopsy the spleen. At the AAD, I was talking, someone asked a question about that. You know, does that mean they have sarcoidosis? Well, I always say it's just like DLE, right? If they have DLE and their ANA, you check an ANA and it's slightly positive, and over time you keep monitoring them. So I say the patient has granulomatous dermatitis consistent with cutaneous sarcoidosis. We'll monitor for evolution of systemic disease. And that's how I keep track of those patients.
So if you have somebody who just has sarcoid in the skin, how do you continue to monitor them?
Well, what I would do with that situation is that obviously through therapy, when they make the routine follow-ups, good review of systems again to see how they're doing. 6 months out, I might repeat their eye exam and their chest x-ray and their EKG concept there in a pattern, and then maybe 6 months after that. But then that's when I start getting the internist involved and saying, hey, I got the skin under control now. I haven't seen anything, but let's get our internist who can do that good physical exam on you routinely.
And then are there particular forms of sarcoid in the skin that are more likely to be associated with sarcoid internally?
That's always a big thing. Is it skin? Is it a prognostic indicator? All patients that have sarcoidal granulomas of the skin consistent with cutaneous sarcoidosis need a systemic workup. They have shown certain ones have more associations, like lupus pernio is classically associated with upper airway disease and bone cysts. They talk about subcutaneous sarcoidosis now in patients that they looked at a couple studies where like 9 out of 10 also had pulmonary involvement. We know that lupus pernio is a chronic disease, but that doesn't change your prognosis. Now, if that lupus pernio patient had cardiac or neurologic, then your prognosis is worse. But skin per se itself for prognosis is not there yet. But the key thing is, if you have sarcoid on the skin biopsy, you got to work them up for systemic.
And when you go back to that lupus pernio patient, because there's been talk about sarcoids, say, in the sinuses or other places, do you do any other imaging or send them to ENT? Or?
Yeah, so there's also subspecialists that you go to. Yeah, if they're coming in and they're talking very nasal, you can get a CT scan or an MRI of the head and neck and then get ENT involved.
What about some other presentations like erythema nodosum or other diseases we might see with our sarcoid patients?
Erythema nodosum, I think, is the classic exciting disease to teach residents. We always talk about the differential. They're pregnant or they're infectious with streptococcus or they have a deep fungal infection. Are they on medications? And also systemic disease, Behçet's, inflammatory bowel are the big ones, right? And then sarcoidosis. So classically, you can get a Lofgren syndrome where you may get lung, eye, and arthralgias with erythema nodosum as presenting sign of sarcoidosis. But also people can get erythema nodosum and have any type of sarcoidosis elsewhere, and it can also become chronic. Now, erythema nodosum goes along with it, and that Lofgren syndrome has a good prognosis, you know, early springtime development, and they get the disease, and boom, you're done, and you have no bad outcome. But there are people that can get erythema nodosum that can develop chronic sarcoidosis systemically and cutaneously elsewhere and persist for a long period of time.
And is there a way to differentiate between who's going to do well and who's not?
Just by following them up and see how you're going to do.
How do you approach treatment in patients with sarcoid?
Well, as with all our patients in dermatology, we'd like to do it with the best evidence-based medicine. That for sarcoidosis being a small subsection of dermatology diseases, it's not like psoriasis where we have a lot of evidence-based medicine. So if you do look at the data, I've sort of come up with a therapeutic ladder, you may say, based on that. Usually when I see a patient initially and I say, this looks like sarcoid, I'm going to do the biopsy, and I'm very convinced that it can be sarcoid, I'll start an oral tetracycline. Usually I do minocycline. One study that showed 8 out of 12 responded over 6 months. I have seen that patients, usually males, respond better than females, and if they do, it's going to be within the first 3 months of therapy.
At what dose?
Usually I do 100 milligrams twice daily. And so I will do that for 3 months while I'm waiting for them to go to their eye doctor, get all the other studies that I wanted done. Usually at the three-month mark, I reevaluate. And if that doesn't work, the next drug with the most data on is Plaquenil. Why don't I do Plaquenil first? Well, I don't have to wait for labs with minocycline. I don't have to monitor labs with minocycline off the bat. So that's why I do the sort of the Plaquenil second. Plaquenil takes a little bit longer to work. Usually you have to wait about 6 months to see if that's a failure or not. And you have to do the eye routine that is always controversial and the G6PDs and all that stuff. And then the next step, if you fail, boom, boom, you're going up the ladder. Next is methotrexate, has quite a bit of good data. And I find that's very... very effective in getting the disease taken care of. And along the way, you can also use interlesional steroids if you have a stubborn lesion to go along. There are other non-systemic therapies like photodynamic therapy, but 22 treatments of photodynamic therapy doesn't seem very effective. So there's no real definitive non-oral medication therapy for it. The other thing you got to remember, too, is that a lot of times these patients will be on other immunosuppressive drugs for other organs involvement and still be getting cutaneous lesions. I had a patient on Cytoxan for ocular sarcoid who had developed verrucous lesions of sarcoid on the leg. And now how are you going to treat that? That makes it a little bit difficult. So you got to try to use your medicine. So you may do methotrexate and not affect the lungs in one way or the other. So after methotrexate, then the big question is, what after that? And that usually gets to our TNF inhibitors. They have tried oral TNF inhibitors, thalidomide, pentoxifilin, and now the new one was just reported in the archives in March of 2012 in a small study being effective for cutaneous sarcoidosis, but that's not available in the United States as of yet. And then you can also go back over to the biologic injectables. The infliximab, adalimumab are the two, probably the ones that are used the most right now. The interesting thing about that is just like biologic agents have been sort of paradoxical in patients being treated for rheumatoid arthritis, it caused a palmar plantar pustulosis, can cause alopecia areata. It's also been shown in patients being treated with biologics for non-sarcoid can develop sarcoidosis from infliximab and etanercept. So, you know, obviously we know the immune system has many different arms. Some get knocked down, some go up, but so you have to be a little bit, you know, cautious on that. The biggest issue on that is getting insurance coverage.
And then going back to methotrexate for some of these folks, do you have a favorite dose that you start with and that you find to be most effective?
Yeah, usually what I try to do is obviously we do a test dose, like 5 milligrams, and I pump them up to 15 right off the bat. I may take it to 20, but if they're not responding by then, I usually say we need another alternative agent.
And why is it that there are treatments that are effective for the skin and not effective otherwise?
That is the million-dollar question. Everyone would like to know that. And the problem is there's a lot of people doing studies on pulmonary sarcoid And every once in a while, they'll pull in the skin to do that. But there's not a lot of people looking at skin. And it's just because academic dermatology is smaller than the pulmonary colleagues. And
do you ever worry that if you give them a medication, say minocycline, that it's going to interfere with their evaluations that they're going to get down the road?
Usually I say no, not in the first couple of months. I don't think you're going to get to the point where you're going to wipe out all the sarcoid. If you do, that's good, right? But I haven't seen that, so I'm not afraid of that.
No, I agree with you on that one. Do we have anything coming down the pipe that you think might be hopeful for patients with sarcoid?
Well, as I mentioned, the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, the pentoxifilin, and the biologic agents. If you go back and look at the innumerous cytokines that are elevated, IL-12 is one of the ones. So the new ustekinumab, also golimumab, are some other ones that are they're trying to do in studies.
Anything else that you want to make sure we covered, Joe?
No, I think we did a great job in covering all the aspects of a very difficult disease sometimes to diagnose and manage. What I like about sarcoidosis, because I consider it the ultimate skin sign of systemic disease, because any organ system can be involved.
Well, Dr. English, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I think this is going to be a topic that's going to be of interest to all of our listeners. Thank you, Joe.
Mike, you've fulfilled one of my dreams to be on Dialogues in Dermatology, this Academy meeting. We go a long way back to our military days, and it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarcoidosis occurs worldwide in all races and ages, but in the United States, it most commonly affects African-American women, followed by African-American men, Caucasian women, and Caucasian men. For reasons that are unclear, the presentation tends to be more acute and severe in African-Americans. Sarcoidosis is more common in industrialized countries, but the reasons for this are speculative. The pathogenesis of sarcoidosis is characterized by an aberrant immune response, specifically hyperactivity of the cell-mediated immune system. CD4-positive T helper cells of the TH subtype are upregulated after antigen presentation by monocytes. An increase in the production of interleukin-2, interferon gamma, and tumor necrosis factor alpha ensues, which results in B cell stimulation and hypergammaglobulinemia. Roles for IL-12 and CD4-positive T-cells of the TH17 subtype have also been implicated. Activated T-helper cells produce monocyte chemotactic factor, which lures monocytes from the circulation into peripheral tissues. Granuloma-forming T-lymphocytes and monocytes are then compartmentalized in the peripheral tissues, leading to both lymphopenia and anergy. Over time, the TH2 subtype develops and predominates. The antigen responsible for initiating these events that culminate in epithelioid granuloma formation has yet to be identified. However, autoimmune and infectious theories have been posited. Genetic susceptibility to sarcoidosis has been associated with HLA-1, HLA-B8, HLA-DR3, HLA-DRB1, and HLA-DQB1 alleles. In addition, polymorphisms in the gene encoding angiotensin-converting enzyme have been reported. Cutaneous sarcoidosis can be divided into specific types in which granulomas are seen on biopsy and nonspecific types in which granulomas are absent, but a reactive inflammatory process such as erythema nodosum is present. Several clinical variants of cutaneous sarcoidosis have been described and include micropapular, papular nodular, and plaque. Lupus pernio is characterized by infiltrative papular nodules and plaques involving areas exposed to cold, i.e. the nose, ears, and cheeks. Both lupus pernio and subcutaneous sarcoidosis, or Dariae-Russi sarcoid, are highly associated with pulmonary sarcoidosis. Atypical and less common variants of cutaneous sarcoidosis include ichthyosiform, scarring alopecia, morpheiform, erythrodermic, ulcerative, and verrucous types. Sarcoidosis is a diagnosis of exclusion made on the basis of historical, clinical, and histopathological finding. Sarcoidosis is an excellent clinical mimicker, and therefore the differential diagnosis depends on the characteristics of the presenting clinical lesions. Histopathology of sarcoidosis reveals superficial and deep dermal epithelioid cell granulomas without prominent infiltrates of lymphocytes or plasma cells. These are thus referred to as naked granulomas. Central caseation is not usually present in sarcoidosis. Multinucleated histiocytes are of the Langhans type, which is typified by nuclei arranged in a circular fashion or peripheral arc. The histological differential diagnosis is broad and includes tuberculoid leprosy, lupus vulgaris, foreign body reactions, granuloma annulare, annular elastolytic giant cell granuloma, necrobiosis lipoidica, rheumatoid nodule, interstitial granulomatous dermatitis, granulomatous rosacea, cutaneous Crohn's disease, chelitis granulomatosa, Blau syndrome, granulomatous mycosis fungoides, Hodgkin's disease, and the sarcoidal reaction pattern to lymphoma. Systemic involvement should be evaluated in all patients once a diagnosis of cutaneous sarcoidosis is made. Basic laboratory investigations should include complete blood count to evaluate for anemia and lymphopenia, comprehensive metabolic panel to examine serum calcium, liver, and renal function. Urinalysis can be obtained to assess for hematuria, which could indicate the presence of nephrolithiasis. Chest x-ray, pulmonary function tests, electrocardiogram, and echocardiogram are also important and can facilitate the overall productivity of initial consultations with pulmonology and cardiology. A referral to ophthalmology is also imperative. Additional referrals to otolaryngology and neurology should be made based on a review of systems that should be assessed at each visit. Therapeutic strategies that have been successful include minocycline, hydroxychloroquine, methotrexate, interlesional steroids, photodynamic therapy, systemic corticosteroids, TNF-alpha inhibitors, thalidomide, pentoxifilin, and apremilast. Interestingly, although TNF-alpha inhibitors have been used successfully to treat patients with sarcoidosis, there have been a number of reports describing the paradoxical development of sarcoidosis in patients with other diseases treated with these biological agents.